There were a couple of questions previously submitted that I thought to respond to start, and then we'll see where it goes. So, a question about working with physical sensations that come and go, or sensations that seem to strengthen through sitting, but not necessarily pain, more like tension or just body sensations. For myself, in learning to sit for long periods of time, I usually get some lower abdominal tension. Once the initial relaxation is complete, would you recommend just observing physical tension if it arises, or continuing to mentally relax and/or adjust posture? I ask especially since I also have a tendency to wiggle if I let myself, but wonder if it's better to be with the wiggling or to assume stillness will be found. Wonder if it's better to be with the wiggling and assume stillness will be found if it wants to, or to set a commitment to stay still and not physically moving. So, there's no one answer here. I think the most important piece is curiosity about this whole process. So, sitting and feeling the tension. Initially, I'd say, and it depends, whether to bring in relaxation there or not. Generally, I'd say as the practice moves on, as the practice gets more momentum, then just noticing the tension and being curious about the relationship to the tension, if we notice tension in the body, rather than noticing tension and immediately trying to relax it, that can be the direction that the practice moves towards, because it becomes more natural to just notice what's arising and notice the relationship to it and see what happens to it. But there are times, kind of in the middle of my 6.5 week retreat with Sayadaw, I noticed just there was so much tension in this one particular sitting that I just spent the entire hour-long sitting just inclining to relaxation. It just felt intuitively like the appropriate response to that much tension. So in that case, that's what the mind chose to do at that time. It just felt very supportive. And so, there's not one right answer here. I think it's important that in the choice of what we do, so checking in to, the motivation for why relax the body, or why just notice the tension. There could be wholesome or unwholesome motivations on either side. It could be, the feeling of tension and the wanting to wiggle, and we're telling ourselves, I'm going to stay still because that's what I'm supposed to do as a meditator. And it's coming from an idea, it's coming from a little bit of greed of wanting to do it right or something like that, as opposed to it being a kind of a wholesome kind of curiosity about, well, what is it like to have this tension? And sometimes when there is physical experience in the body, very naturally the body will respond to it, and just seeing that movement happens. So very different. So check the attitude, check the relationship to the experience. Be curious about the process. If you start wiggling, be curious about the process of that. You may, with enough attention and mindfulness, know that you're going to wiggle before you wiggle, and then have a sense of what's the reason why you're going to wiggle. If you don't notice that intention and you find yourself already wiggling, don't give yourself a hard time about it. Just notice that. That's what's happening in that moment. Those were the conditions that happened. So whatever's happening, we can be curious about it. So we don't have to try to hold ourselves still in the face of physical difficulty. And yet I made a suggestion yesterday, maybe, I don't remember, a day or two ago, around the urge to get up, the urge to stop the meditation. And I encouraged to, check in. What is that urge like? And watch it happen twice fully. Watch the urge come and go. It'll happen a second time. Watch it come and go a second time. And the third time, get up. You could do the same thing with play the same way with an intention to move with physical discomfort. If there's pain in the body or physical discomfort, you could just sit with it, knowing that it's okay to move the third time it gets really strong. Or Sayadaw sometimes says, just if it gets too strong, then it's fine to move. But play with it, see if you can notice the pain without immediately following through on especially a reactive intention to move, because we don't like the pain. So, just notice the experience, notice the aversion that comes with the experience. Maybe you see the aversion get stronger, get weaker. You learn something about how that aversion is often what's motivating our movement. You may notice compassion arise at some point too, instead of aversion, and feel the difference between when compassion arises with pain and when aversion arises with pain. So there's just a lot to see in exploring pain and unpleasant body sensations. But you could play with it in the same way of, watching it for a few minutes. And then at some point, if it feels like it just gets too strong or the mind starts getting tired, because being with pain, Sayadaw Upandita says at times, he used this phrase on one retreat I sat with him, said that pain, if we stay with pain for too long, it can get wearying. The mind can get weary with it. And so there are times when it's not helpful to try to stay with pain. And we can, in this practice, we can explore compassionate movement to alleviate the pain. Sometimes we can't alleviate the pain through movement, and it's a chronic kind of pain. And in that case, we can potentially learn to redirect the attention, turn to something else, just give our minds a break from watching that pain. Be aware of a larger container, those other things I've talked about in terms of working with difficulty. And then another question that is kind of looking at more the questions about the arc of this practice and where it heads and that kind of thing. So I'll read this question too. It's kind of, there's a lot here. Would you say in this practice there's a particular orientation towards meditative states like jhana access concentration, or more informal, unnamed, altered states of mind that may not be as specifically tied to concentration? It seems clear that these are not front and center as they are in some traditions, but I was curious as to whether this would be considered a dry insight, where that's mostly off the table, those states, I assume is what this person's referring to, where those states are off the table, or a situation where years of practice often induces those states, but it's just another thing to be observed. As a beginner, I don't think I'm especially close to having that as an option anyway, so the question stems more from trying to understand how this approach can work in the longer term. So this particular practice is, I suppose it could be considered a dry insight practice in that we're not particularly aiming for concentration. The wet practices. It's the practices that are called wet practices are typically ones that use focused concentration. And this is not a practice that uses focused concentration. It doesn't aim towards focused concentration. Focused concentration can be lovely. It can be a place where we can kind of find a break sometimes from the intensity of the dukkha that comes up sometimes with mindfulness practice. So, that's one reason why some practices emphasize the concentration to give ourselves a place to come back to in some of those kinds of situations where it's particularly challenging. In this practice, we just explore being with what is. And yet, as the question points to, these states are not off the table. Because these states are just states of mind. They happen. They happen in our practice. It depends somewhat on conditions, what states are available or happening. But it was a little bit of a surprise to me at one point. I think I mentioned this the other day, just in passing almost. I did a long retreat at the Forest Refuge at one point and just did this practice. I just started with this practice. I had been doing a mixture of concentration practice and this practice earlier and had discovered I had gone in the previous couple of years, actually, before that retreat at the Forest Refuge I'm getting ready to describe. In the previous couple of years, I had been doing concentration practice. And discovered for myself that when the mind got really kind of tight with the concentration practice, that the open awareness practice was really my refuge. That was what I could step back into. In a way, that's where my mind could rest. It was much more restful to be in open awareness than it was to try to make the mind concentrated. And so, some traditions teach that concentration is the rest, but that's not what my experience was. My experience was letting go of trying to make that concentration happen. That was way more restful. And so just letting myself rest between times where the mind got a little bit over engaged, a little bit tight in the concentration, I discovered that, that kind of rest, just being with, oh, this is what's happening right now, very naturally allowed the concentration that, once I turned back towards concentration practice, it was like so easy. And I began to be curious about that. It felt to me like this open awareness practice was the access for this mind into concentration practice. And so I went back to the Forest Refuge sometime later, intending to just start with this open awareness practice. And just see where it went, just see what happened. And what happened is that it went into concentration, partly, I think, because the Forest Refuge is such a still container. There's not a lot going on at the Forest Refuge. Really quiet, not a lot of yogis, not many things, it's a pretty unstructured schedule. I could sit for hour and 45 minutes, no bells. It was great. And then on top of that, at some point, the boiler went out, and the boiler is the thing that pushes the water through the entire complex. And so there wasn't this background hum of the boiler, the noise of the boiler, the noise of the water going through the wall. The building got so quiet. And with that condition, the mind just plunged into stillness, just by being aware. It wasn't choosing an object. I was actually working with somebody who was very skilled in focused meditation, and I described how the mind was settling. It's like I said, the mind is just seeing that there's some agitation, and it's letting go of that agitation, and it comes to a stiller place. And then in that stiller place, it hangs out there for a little while, then it notices there's some other disturbance and it lets that go. And then it's a stiller place. And she said, that's how my teacher, Pao Aksayadaw, describes the entry into concentration. And I said, but I'm not focusing on an object. She said, it doesn't matter. That's how concentration is created. And so this practice it led to some very deep states of concentration in those conditions. Now, in daily life, there's so much going on, it's probably not going to lead to that kind of stillness. But the practice itself, just the awareness of what's here, what's here, what's here. What we're essentially doing is exploring the possibility of moving in the direction of not having reactivity to what's happening in the moment. And so, very directly with this practice, we are exploring the possibility of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. Noticing the presence of greed, aversion, and delusion when it's there, checking the attitude, that aspect of, as we check the attitude, we see some kind of reactivity, and there's some flavor of greed or aversion or delusion in our reactivity. And so the checking into the relationship to experience very directly points us to begin to recognize when greed, aversion, and delusion are functioning in our experience. And the encouragement to get to know them, we start to see them fall away. We notice the difference between greed, aversion, and delusion, and non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. The Buddhist definition of freedom in the suttas, the clearest and most concise definition of nibbana, of freedom, is the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, and the absence of delusion. This practice is going directly to that. I will say, that I spent several years with this practice. I can't even remember how many years I spent with this practice, with some niggling doubt in my mind that it's too simple. Just to be aware of what's here and notice the attitude. It's too simple. I thought this can't possibly lead to freedom. So that was a kind of just doubt in my mind. It's like, don't I have to be creating those really deep states of concentration in order to see something really clearly, in order to have that freedom? Isn't that the way it works? After a certain point with this practice, after one retreat at the Forest Refuge, I came back with the confidence and the sense of, yes, this practice is sufficient. There doesn't need to be some other practice that will somehow strengthen the mindfulness so that I can then see more clearly. This practice itself can strengthen the mindfulness to the level that it can let go, release greed, aversion, and delusion. I have confidence in that. And those other practices are also great. I mean, I'm not saying that, this is the only way. This is a way. It is a tool. It is a form of practice that is valid in its own right. It's complete in its own right. And the Mahasi practice too, really valuable. I learned a lot from the Mahasi practice. I learned a lot from spending a couple of years trying to focus on the mindfulness of breathing. I spent, the first probably 5 years of my practice doing Mahasi practice, and then met Sayadaw's practice, and then started doing some concentration practice. So I've done a lot of different kinds of practices and found all of them to have support and be valuable. This now is pretty much my main practice. It is the one that feels intuitively feels like the mind is, it's like I kind of feel like it creates the conditions for the mind to find its way to freedom, rather than me thinking I know the way to freedom. So that feels intuitively like this is my path. But it may not be everybody's path. You know, the other minds, I have one friend, she died some years ago, but her path was really concentration. You know, it was easy for her. She could sit down and relax and, you know, after a day of work and go into the jhanas. And it was just so easy and natural for her. That was not my experience, but that was her path. There was so much learning that she could have. So different minds have different ways in. And sometimes in talking to people and working with people individually on their practice, I kind of listen for what's most natural, what's most, the most natural way in for that person to be mindful, to be aware, to connect with experience. Because the easiest way in is probably the most natural doorway for anyone. For any one particular person. So I felt like it was worth spending a little bit of time talking about the, you know, the trajectory and how this, and this practice, you know, this practice might be the whole of your practice, but also as I pointed out, I noticed in the concentration practice an interweaving, a blending of this practice with the concentration practice was supportive for the concentration practice. So, you know, the tools of this practice, some of the tools of this practice, relax, receive experience. You know, receptivity was huge in terms of working with concentration. Can I receive the breath instead of trying to go out and find it? That was a revelation. You know, trying to, instead of trying to like hook to the breath with the mind, the attention, it's like settle back and see what the breath is that wants to come to you. Oh, there's another breath. There's another breath received. So the support of the learning how to do the receptive awareness supported the concentration practice. So these practices can support each other, and we don't have to necessarily even think about only doing one. There are times and ways we find, you know, the support. So, like in this practice, when the mind gets really agitated and it's not possible to just be with what's here, bringing in some of our other practices, metta practice or concentration practice, the practices that you know will support you.